There are so many reasons to join Starfleet. We get to reach for the stars. We get to reach for the best in ourselves. We get to reach for each other.
On your mark, Commander.
Ready.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton having DEFCON levels of fun.
Are you?
No. And why is that, Cam? Well, I guess I can go into it. We had some technical issues with our initial recording of the podcast, so what you're hearing right now is more of an abbreviated version that you and I were re-recording the podcast. We're going to do a bit of a kind of a lightning round of some of the highlights, some of the big things that we need to get into. The first big thing here, the revelation of the Red Angel. It's not actually Burnham, as we were led to believe in the first 5 minutes of the show and how many people speculated.
Yes.
It's Burnham's mom. How does this work for you as a revelation for the identity that they've been teasing for 10 episodes so far?
Teasing is the key word there. They teased it a lot, and I think that if you're going to tease out a mystery this long, you want a payoff that maybe surprises you or shocks you, and I don't know that it did that for me. This felt to me a little similar to really the last episode, where Arium's last word was, you know, Project Daedalus, where we're like, I don't know what that means, but I guess this is going somewhere. And that's the way I felt about this. Like, I felt like, okay, it's Michael Burnham's mom. I don't know what this means. Well, and it's kind of like a teaser for the next episode.
For me, it's like planting seeds for doing some character stuff with Burnham that should be interesting, though. And
but is
so,
that enough after this much buildup? Like, in the sense of having an episode called The Red Angel, revealing The Red Angel, is that enough, do you think, for most fans?
I think a lot of fans are going to go, huh, what?
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of fans were, you know, saying, it's going to be Patrick Stewart. He's going to do a cameo role or something. He's going to be the Red Angel. I'm like, I don't know, guys. You know, in this situation, I'm not looking at towards, you know, the big twist of it all. I really didn't expect that, you know, Deanna Troi or Commander Riker or some, or Quark was going to be like popping out of the Red Angel outfit. I thought it had to tie back to the canon that they've built within this series so far. And I wasn't really all that shocked when they were saying that, oh yeah, it's Burnham. I'm like, okay, I guess that makes sense. And that's why there's that strong Spock and Burnham connection moving forward.
I thought it was Mirror Universe Burnham at a certain point,
which
wouldn't have necessarily made sense when you break it down as to why she would care about Spock much. But I was like, that would explain the DNA being the same.
Mirror Burnham wanted him to get rid of that beard and just go all goatee. That's why she was interfering with this particular timeline here.
You got to admit, though, had it been Mirror Burnham, that would explain a lot as to why Georgiou's around this season.
Yeah.
Like, to tie it all together, right?
Yeah, maybe the Red Angel's not really about Burnham and Spock. It's all about Georgiou. Yeah.
And Discovery as a whole.
Yeah. So other stuff, big stuff going on that is a big highlight for me, though. I loved all of the Spock and Burnham moments here.
Yeah.
These actors, they have got chemistry. And as long as they can keep going back and forth like squabbling siblings, which we did get to see with Burnham and Saru in maybe the first two episodes, I think the show's kind of been missing that dynamic. And these two actors and these two characters have really proven this can be fun.
Spock is really good at squabbling. Like, that's one of the great joys of the original series, is watching him and McCoy just squabble all the time. And Burnham doesn't have a character to do that with. Her and Tilly, it's a very like positive, you know, friendship where they really support one another. Burnham's a character who's very serious. She has a lot of monologues on the show, a lot of talking about what space means and what humanity should strive for. You know, she is the character that represents Star Trek, which isn't necessarily the fun character. And so having Spock there, getting these digs in at her and her getting annoyed back, it actually gives the character fun moments. It's an organic way to do it. Like, I love when Spock calls her out in like the meeting and, you know, says like, this is classic you or to do these sorts of things. And she's like, thanks for calling me out, Spock.
Yes.
You know, it's just like so awesome to see these types of moments with Burnham. I want to see more of this sort of stuff because I think Sonequa Martin-Green is really good with funny moments. It's just that they don't write her a lot of them.
And I have to bring up that meeting that you were bringing about is being administered by one Dr. Culber.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Dr. Pollard. Even though we have a guy who's not actually currently serving as a doctor on the ship, he's going to be administering all the tests here. Maybe that explains why he mistakenly thought that it was confirmed 100% to be Michael Burnham. I don't know. But
is this a problem with the show in the sense of, like, they didn't want to have your standard, you know, chief engineer, chief medical officer as your main characters? But then why are those characters not being involved in these meetings and these extremely important scenarios?
It doesn't quite register with me. I'm like, huh, okay.
Yeah.
But I think we need to talk about it. Culber, finally, he has a therapy session, long overdue.
Which I said I wanted. I wanted badly for Culber to see a therapist, and yet, you know, Admiral Cornwell was right in front of me, and I didn't even name check her as a possible therapist.
But, you know, she hasn't been super, super active this season.
No, I think
before last week's episode, Project Daedalus, she had appeared in just one episode. She was telling Chris and Leland to cool their jets and not have, like, a masculinity off.
Right.
So,
she wasn't at the very start of the season, was she? In some sort of brief shot? I don't think so. No? Okay.
Yeah. So, here, look, she's trying to give him advice or at least lead him down a path for some existential, you know, insights here. Where do you think Culber's going at this point? Because she leads him down a path where it says that he kind of needs to break free from his relationship with Stamets. He doesn't want to disappoint him, and he feels that that's the reason why he's with Stamets right now, is because he just doesn't want to disappoint the man. Although he did move out of their quarters.
Yes. I mean, I'm confused as to what they're doing in the sense of, like, I know that it's a trope, you know, in TV, movies, comic books, it's very popular to break up a couple just because the writers find it harder to write interesting stories about a happy couple than one that's, you know, in a tumultuous period. And so that seems to be what they're doing, but it also seems like they're almost opening the door for Culber to just head off, like, on his own adventure somewhere and continue on as, like, a recurring character on the show who pops in every now and again, but maybe is still in the opening credits. Like, I'm finding it very confusing because we have almost too many characters doing that, with Ash Tyler off on his own things and then coming back and so on, and then Mirror Georgiou doing the same thing. And it's weird to have a show set on a ship. I mean, maybe it's not weird. It's just that we're not used to it in Star Trek, of having these characters not kind of exist as one sort of family unit on the ship versus having a whole handful of them just who wander off and go off and do their own thing.
I mean, I don't see him wandering off and coming back in season three. I see him either being permanently assigned to the ship.
Right.
Or else he's kind of out of it. Like, he needs to go off on his own journey. It's one in which he can kind of cut ties with Paul to a certain degree. Although, you know, I say that out loud, it would not make sense for Paul's ex-husband to be out and about in outer space and never encountering him one again. And I say ex-husband purely as speculation, that's what they end up going with the character.
And we know that fans loved Culber. They desperately wanted him back. And so they did this whole really convoluted retcon to bring him back. Does it make any sense to bring that character back through such torturous means and then have him be like, well, goodbye, guys?
Yeah, so maybe he is back on the ship. Maybe he's just not in a relationship with Stamets. And maybe that's kind of causing continued friction between these two, you know, characters, officers that are going to have to encounter each other and work together. We haven't really seen kind of a divorced couple on Star Trek before.
No.
Like,
no, I mean, you had, like, a former couple with Troy and Riker, but that was, like, the most civil couple ever.
Yeah.
No, you're right. No. So that could be an interesting thing to see. But, I mean, Cornwell's advice was just vague enough that it opens the door for all sorts of things, because she says, you know, walk, you know, along a new road. What is that? That could mean anything. And it opens the door to doing different things with the character, hopefully, that don't fall into the two things we've come up to.
Yeah.
Or come up with.
The other thing that I think should go without saying here is, well, Culber, he was dispatched rather unceremoniously.
Yeah.
They were not going to pull that with, say, Arium, who literally had a Kelpian sing for her at her funeral here. Was this a little over the top, or do you think it was what this background player deserved, Cam?
Had this fallen in a previous episode. Like, you didn't have that Arium-centric episode last week, and she just died randomly.
Yeah.
It would have felt really weird. But after last week's episode, which I thought was such an emotional high point of season two, I think this felt like a natural follow-up to it. Like, I'm totally cool with it. I thought it was a fantastic scene. I thought you had great speeches from multiple characters talking about all the wonderful things Arium said on her time on the ship that off camera.
We were never privy to.
But it gave us a little bit of backstory. I thought it was interesting hearing Detmer say about how her implants, you know, Arium saw it as like a new beginning and it, you know, followed that philosophy. I thought that was great. So I thought it was a really, really beautiful scene. And I mean, it opened with the body on the slab, basically. You know, it's the way of Discovery saying, this character is dead. Trust us.
Yes. Or is she? Because, of course, we had Lieutenant Nilsen show up at the towards the end of the episode.
Wait. Tyler, how are these two things related?
Well, Cam, for those who may not be in the know, Sarah Mitich played Arium in season one of Star Trek Discovery. She left that role. What we heard was issues with makeup, allergic reactions to the extensive Arium makeup. And Sarah Mitich is now playing one Lieutenant Nilsen, who turns out is replacing Arium at the console, which is interesting little shout out there.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting because it really then led me to wonder whether Arium was always, when they sat down to break the story of season two, if Arium was always going to die, or if, because Sarah Mitich had to leave the role, and when you recast, often when you recast, that version has a truncated lifespan on the show or something. Like,
did anyone actually notice that she was recast, though?
No, they didn't.
And they wouldn't have, just based on her look. Like, she's under so much makeup. I think what happened, though, is the writers are breaking the story. They're like, hey, we want to tie it into AI. We've got an augmented character. It's a fan favorite. She's got a real cool look. Maybe we can do a death scene. We've teased a couple death scenes so far on Discovery. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at you, Saru. Maybe let's, you know, put some meat on this bone, give her a kind of a way to go out on our high note here. And hey, look, it was too bad about the original actress with the makeup. I think we can bring her back and find a way for her to still be on the show, because it is kind of mean-spirited where somebody's literally having like a physically horrible time underneath all the makeup, and the producers say, you're out of here, go away. You know, so I think they're at least, you know, being or displaying a little bit of humanity, which isn't such a bad thing.
Do you think fans are going to rally behind Nilsen? Is this character going to be someone that they, you know, have some sort of interest in?
Well, the thing is, are fans rallying behind, say, Reese or Bryce?
I would say no.
Yeah, but I think fans like Owashikin and they like Detmer, you know, so those, it really depends on what they do with Nilsen. So far, she's getting a couple II captains, which is kind of what Arium was doing, but at least Arium had the cool voice and the cool look.
Arium had the Boba Fett factor.
Yeah.
You just have to look cool and people start coming up with their own stories. Who is that really, really cool character?
Speaking of which, Ash Tyler.
Whoa.
He and Burnham, in a moment of vulnerability, Burnham embraces him, makes out with him after initially telling him she does not ever want to be in a relationship with him. There's so many things wrong with this particular relationship. It is not a healthy relationship, and I fear very much we're
really
gonna
I thought it was very healthy.
I fear very much we're gonna have one puppy dog eyed Ash Tyler in the next few episodes, pining over Burnham.
For the next few episodes? Tyler, when have we had any different?
You know, that's a very good point here. I just don't know what they're doing with this Tyler character. It's difficult for me to care too much about where his arc is going. I thought his arc ended in season one, where he said, I'm going to hang around on Kronos with Laurel. I thought that made a lot of perfect sense, and they kind of did away with that almost instantly when he came back in season two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found this scene frustrating because on one hand, like, I thought Sonequa Martin-Green was absolutely fantastic in it. She has that moment where she kind of, you know, kisses him, but then she says, like, I'm scared, and has this, like, breakdown. And I thought this episode had multiple moments where she was just fantastic. You know, the funeral I mentioned, but, like, the scene where she's in this chair about to, you know, have herself killed. All that sort of stuff. I thought she was on fire. And that scene with Ash Tyler, she's great. I'm loving what she's bringing. But Ash Tyler, this character, and I don't know how much is really the fault of the actor, but Ash Tyler is such a passive character who just seems to sit in his quarters and wait for things to happen a lot of the time.
Well, I mean, he did get his wristband taken off.
He did.
Yeah, so
I mean, how many scenes have we seen in the show where someone has to go visit him in his quarters to get something out of him?
Well, it's kind of like he's not done a whole lot of cool things. You know, when you think of the security chief, or I guess now he's a Section 31 specialist. You hear Section 31 specialist, you're like, oh, this guy must be a total badass.
You think of like Garrick type stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, where it's like, you know, he's done things, man. Those eyes have seen things. But
we haven't gotten that.
Even as a security chief, none has done cooler things at this point in season two than Ash Tyler ever did. I think the coolest thing he ever did on season one was probably in the, you know, the holographic simulation of combat where he was really, really good at like combat compared to Lorca's score. Like that moment set him up as like, this is a formidable security officer. And then we saw nothing of it. Whereas, like, none, we haven't had the whole fanfare of her arrival as the new security chief. It was like, oh, okay, cool. And then she's gotten fantastic moments of looking hyper-competent and badass.
Yeah. The other weird thing that I think we want to talk about, though, is that scene with Giorgio and Stamets and Culber, where she's just laying it all out about how you shouldn't be so binary, which, I mean, I can't really blame the producers for wanting to introduce that, but it was such a bizarre scene that even Tilly had to comment on it with, what was that? I loved her commentary there, but...
Do you think there was, like, smoke coming off the writers' pens when they were writing that scene?
Look, it was, like a pretty hilarious thing to watch go down.
Yeah.
And I kind of like having a character like Giorgio to pull people out of their comfort zones, even though it is a little weird where she's literally putting the moves on all the gay men.
Yeah.
You know, they're pointing out, hey, we are gay. And she's like, well, you know what? Maybe you shouldn't be so confined to those sorts of labels. So, I mean, I don't know how the LGBTQ community is going to react. And I say that as if there's some sort of monolith. I'm sure there's some people that'll think that is delightful. Other people that are like, I don't know what the intentions of the writers, but, you know.
There has been controversy in the past with the way the Mirror Universe shows these very, you know, pansexual or bisexual characters who are usually evil.
Right.
And it's not tied to, like, positive characters. And, you know, she says Mirror Universe Stamets was pansexual. It's not like that character was a particularly nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was, like, kind of a lunatic.
And as she said, as Giorgio said, he wasn't nearly as smart as the Prime Universe version of Stamets.
Which was very true. He was not that cool either.
Yeah. So.
And so I kind of like that she acknowledged that. But we also had the death of Leland with Section 31. Maybe the death?
Maybe.
Question mark?
I don't, it was kind of weird. Like, look,
death by eye stabbing?
If I had my eye stabbed through with some sort of sharp object and then all you see me is collapse on the ground, I'm assuming I'm dead, you know, like otherwise, like if I lived through that, I would be writhing in pain running to the sick bay.
I mean, Leland with an eye patch would make a lot of sense just aesthetically.
Yeah.
But what did you think of this moment for this character? A character that I found very frustrating in that it felt like they were really building him up to be something interesting, an interesting personality within Section 31, at least right off the very, very bat. He never seemed to get those moments. And if this is the end of the character, I don't know.
I think maybe if it was a swan song, it was meant to be the confrontation with Burnham literally punching this guy twice in the face. Here's for my mom, here's for my dad.
I'm glad you brought that up. Why was he so bloody after two punches from Burnham there, but like other characters have gotten in fights and there's nowhere near as much blood?
I think she can throw a punch.
I guess, but Giorgio wasn't that bloody when the two of them had it out like a week ago.
Maybe he's just very, very fragile.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Well, he's like a desk guy.
Yeah. Or maybe, you know, because he's so good at his job at Section 31, he's just never been punched before.
Oh.
He doesn't know how to take a punch.
That's good call. He's the guy behind the scenes, too.
Yeah.
Like puts his operatives out front to get punched, and then he hides in the back.
What did you think of his revelation to Burnham that his negligence as an ambitious young officer was what essentially caused the death of her parents? Time crystals.
I thought it was an interesting...
Which is a bit of callback to Harry Mudd. And
he also
brought up the Orion Syndicate, which is kind of cool.
I thought it was an interesting character moment. I mean, obviously, it's mostly there for, you know, backstory, to build up the reveal of this Red Angel. But for a character, I actually thought it was interesting character building in that it showed this level of humanity to him, at least that he was willing to reveal. Who knows if it's all smokescreen with Section 31. But, like, again, we've gotten these kind of moments of that there's a more complex person beneath the facade of who this character is. It's just that Discovery's never actually gone there. This was probably the closest they've come. And then if this was his exit, I find that really frustrating because it's kind of like he was only alive to have this conversation with Burnham and then die.
Yeah.
And I'm still unclear as to why he died.
Or if he died.
But I mean, let's just say he did die, just for the sake of argument.
Yeah, but why?
Like, why did he die?
I didn't understand it.
I mean...
You and I discussed this in our original recording.
Yeah, yeah.
He was trying to remove the safeties and had to stick his face into that, like...
I guess it was just like a scanner, retina scanner or something like that. Yeah, yeah.
It seemed very, very intricate and complex.
It also didn't look like what I usually see as a retina scanner. It looked like he was staring into like a microscope
or
something.
Or like he was going to the optometrist. And she was like, okay, does the E look blurry now?
That's the optometrist from hell.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, like when I saw that scene, my takeaway in the moment, who knows if I'm right, but was that it was a Giorgio booby trap.
Yeah. So, Cam, we've talked about kind of the highlights from this episode, though. Where does this episode really rank for you overall when we're looking at season two of Discovery?
I think this episode is... a lower tier episode, not as much by quality, but more by design. A lot of the episodes of Discovery, you know, we've had some really great ones, like the episode where they go to Talos IV, for example, which told a really compelling story on its own. This episode was all process. It was building to a reveal, but it wasn't actually giving us a payoff. So it's kind of an in-between episode, just in terms of its structure within the run of the season. So how great can it really be? It's kind of like The War Without, The War Within from the last season. It's like, that's a solid episode, but it's not telling an individual story that's that interesting. This one maybe gets us to a really great episode maybe next week, but it's sort of forgettable. But I do think it's better than the two other examples of this we've seen this season with Point of Light and...
Saints of Imperfection?
Yeah, Saints of Imperfection. Whereas I felt like those were really jumbled and chaotic and just cramming plot threads together, this one had a lot of things going on, but they had moments to breathe. It didn't feel like anything was being rushed. The writing felt really sharp with the dialogue. It's just that the takeaway of the actual episode was a little unsatisfying.
Well, we keep asking ourselves every single time we do a podcast, you know, what does this add up to?
Yeah.
And I guess what it was all just adding up to was the revelation that the Red Angel was Burnham's mom. And the problem is, as much as I think this is going to be giving her a lot of cool stuff to do further down the road, is it giving her cool stuff to do right now in the immediate aftermath of this, aside from that very horrific death sequence that we witnessed her go through?
Which I thought was really well handled. And I thought, even if you don't buy Michael Burnham's going to die, Sonequa Martin-Green sold me that she was terrified going into this. Like, the character was going through an experience, and you know, her farewell kind of to Spock was really tense and thought and really well written. And so, you know, this episode is the kind of one where I'll remember moments throughout, and some of them are stronger than the types of moments we saw in other connective tissue episodes in the past of Discovery. So, hey, if this episode is kind of like what I can expect from connective tissue episodes of Star Trek Discovery going forward, I'm okay with it. I just don't think on its own it's an okay to good episode. It's just not what Star Trek Discovery is when it's at its best.
Well, what I'm walking away from here is that Ethan Peck and Sonequa Martin-Green have some real chemistry, and I just really want to see them go back and forth. They've got a great dynamic, and that's what I'm looking forward to through the rest of the season, is witnessing that.
Ethan Peck is not going anywhere. He is sticking around in some ways in the future.
We'll see what the future holds. Look, we've had a lot of speculation about whether there's going to be a Pike spinoff and he would jump ship onto that, or who knows if he's somehow seconded to Discovery versus Enterprise. I don't know, but I think that there's a lot of Star Trek in the future for Ethan Peck.
Maybe more than he even wants. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. You can hop over there and we'll have a video up about the Red Angel going a little more in depth than we did in this abbreviated podcast episode. As well, we'll be back next week with a review of the episode Perpetual Infinity. We are also on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in vocals. By Doug Jones Smith.
You can find me at Reporton. That's REPORTON. N as in Nielsen equals new fan favorite.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.